Welcome to Trust in Tech, a project by the Integrity Institute. I'm Alice Hunsberger. In this episode, we talk with Sahar Misachi and Jeff Allen, the founders of the Integrity Institute, a community-driven think tank which advances the theory and practice of protecting the social internet. We talk about the issues around integrity and tech and why the Integrity Institute was founded, how to define integrity work, and why integrity teams are the true long-term growth teams of tech companies. We have a bit of a deep dive into hate speech and talk about several reasons why it's important to remove it, and the dreaded death spiral that can happen when platforms don't invest in integrity properly. We also discuss why building social media companies is an ethical endeavor and the work the Integrity Institute has done to establish a code of ethics and a Hippocratic Oath for integrity workers. And we touch on Jeff and Sahar's thoughts on safety regulation for the industry, the importance of initial members to define a group's norms, the benefit to growing slowly, and why integrity workers are heroes. So let's get to it. Jeff and Sahar, before we get into details of the Integrity Institute itself, can you start out by telling us about your backgrounds and how you met?
I'm Jeff Allen. I am the acting as chief research officer for the Integrity Institute. A quick background on me. So in the long, long ago, I was a physicist, actually, working as a research scientist at NYU. But I left the physics world and academia to get into data science. And this is around 2013, 2014. My first job in data science and in tech was actually at About.com, which is an online internet publisher. And so as a data scientist for About.com, your job is actually kind of to reverse engineer Google search. So did that for a few years, which was a ton of fun. And so it's a little bit of my first experience in the integrity space was actually a little bit on the other side of the fence and doing my best and then failing ultimately to give the Google search quality engineers a hard time. After leaving About.com, I jumped over to Facebook. And so my thinking there was, instead of reverse engineering a platform, what about building a platform? Maybe that's a more interesting thing to do with your life. And, you know, it was interesting times. I worked on the Pages integrity team, which was sort of formed after the IRA scandals and the various scandals in the 2016 election, cleaning out all the bad actors in the Pages ecosystem. And then jumped over to Instagram, where I was on the Instagram content quality team. And that was a team that was worried about various integrity issues in Instagram's recommended content products. So the Explore tab on Instagram, if you hit the search button, you know, it shows you a grid of photos from accounts that you don't follow that Instagram is recommending to you. And so trying to worry about all the integrity issues there. After leaving Instagram, did a little bit of work in politics in the 2020 cycle, but then ultimately, really the real story was in 2021 when I was unemployed, hanging out, and one of my former friends from Facebook was like, "Hey, Jeff, if you're not doing anything, you should go talk to Sahar and about this project that he's starting up."
What a nice segue. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Alice. So my name's Sahar Misachi. I was born in Israel to two refugees from Iran. And we moved to the United States when I was 2 years old. And because of that, I was sort of exposed to this concept of things in the news matter. And you know, we live in a society that could be dangerous from an early age. In college, I studied computer science, but my friends were all confused and thought I was studying politics or history or I don't know, peace and coexistence studies, because that was kind of the vibe I gave off. And my entire adult life has been about balancing, am I a computer boy or a sort of care about the world person? And how do I do both? My claim to fame before working at Facebook was that I worked at Wikipedia with the banners that asked people for money. I ran the sort of data on that. And just as a plug for Wikipedia, they really just like, we raised as much money as we needed and then we stopped. It's the only nonprofit I've ever seen do that in the world. Just like raise the budget, then stop asking. And so I joined Facebook. I started at the growth team around the same time that Jeff had joined Facebook, early 2016. And it turns out that growth is really relevant to integrity. I did that for a while, but pretty soon I found out that there was a civic engagement team. And the civic engagement team had, you know, an oath of conduct that you had to swear to join the team. The civic engagement team turned into sort of the election integrity team, the civic integrity team after the IRA scandals and the other one, Cambridge Analytica. And all of a sudden we moved away from, hey, you should know where your polling place is and who's on the ballot and maybe message your Congress or your mayor between elections, to protecting people and elections and democracies from Facebook and from people sort of abusing the systems. My coworkers, quickly my buddies, and I built the first ever tool to track an election for integrity problems at Facebook, which was the 2017 special election, Doug Jones versus Roy Moore. And then I helped build the first Facebook war room for tracking elections in the Brazilian election in the US midterms in 2018. After that, I also left around the same time as Jeff, a little bit after, end of 2019. And I was a Berkman fellow. And at Berkman, I was surrounded by all these fancy people and just saying things that felt really obvious. I think anyone, any member would find the things that I was saying pretty just basic stuff to integrity professionals. And the people around me just were just treating me like some sort of like exotic expert who like had all this wisdom and knowledge. And it just didn't really feel right or fair to be, you know, the integrity guy. And it felt like we should build a home for all integrity professionals to have the same kind of platform I had. And so I called up the most impressive integrity people I knew. And we started meeting in early February, 2021. And, you know, I knew Jeff by reputation, but we had never met. Never even had a phone call or a Zoom call. And so the first time that we met was in that first planning meeting a little bit before Valentine's Day, February, 2021.
And this planning meeting, was it the seed of what was to become the Integrity Institute?
Yeah, I had this deck of why social media is broken, how you'd fix it. And we need some sort of think tank of integrity professionals to sort of explain it all. And when I showed it to people, they would say, you know, I agree with 70% of what you said. I disagree with another 30%. And my killer move would be to say, great, don't you want to disagree with me in public? The world deserves to know. And so that was a meeting of the people for whom that pitch was exciting. And we had sort of the sketched out idea of, like, you know, the barest sort of cocktail napkin version of what we could be. And we spent months on calls just figuring it out together. And I just want to say that, like, just immediately, Jeff really stood up and said, like, yes, this is great. We're going to do it together. So, you know, we've been co-founders since like end of February, 2021. It was like remarkably quick and like remarkably sort of deep and trusting. And I feel grateful every day that Jeff's here.
When you talk about the sort of team of people that you got together that you know and trust, and the team of people that you envision being part of the Integrity Institute in general, who does that include?
A quick and dirty sort of way to explain it, right, is people who have experience working for social media companies, trying to mitigate all of the various types of harms that can occur on them. So, you know, integrity professionals are the people that are fighting hate speech from inside the platforms and misinformation and self-harm content from inside the platforms. But really, there's a huge spectrum of problems and ways to tackle the problems, as well as roles, right? So roles, it's really spans any sort of job at the tech company, right? So it could be an engineer or a data scientist or a designer or a user researcher or a product manager or policy expert or operations manager. So there's just like a ton of different roles and, you know, areas of expertise from a technical point of view, right? But then also like from the problem space. And so I think how we've defined it a little bit is, you know, integrity work spans a pretty broad spectrum, and it gets a little bit fuzzy on the borders of it, because a lot of these things are still being defined just, you know, industry-wide. But roughly speaking, on one gray area, one fuzzy end of the spectrum is around cybersecurity, right? And so we don't necessarily consider cybersecurity to be integrity work per se, because that's, you know, mainly protecting the platform from outside attackers. But then right next to cybersecurity, you have, you know, threat intel groups, right, that are, you know, fighting foreign actors that are probably very adjacent to the same groups that are hacking, right, but trying to use the platform for their information operation, right, instead of hacking operation. And that we sort of would count as an integrity work. So that's one gray area. On the other side, you can have things like feed ranking, right? And so there's various people working on feed ranking that are trying to maximize the time that people are spending in various feeds and engagement that are going into various feeds. And that probably isn't necessarily integrity work, but there's also a lot of people working in those exact same teams that are trying to figure out, okay, well, what are the systemic sort of harms that we have to worry about, you know, based on how feed is currently designed. And that absolutely is integrity work.
Yeah, I think we're still trying to figure out like a really concise definition, but there, you know, if you just look at where the dots are, it's pretty clear like what counts and what doesn't. And maybe a few succinct ways to talk about it are, integrity is about protecting like from abuse of platforms. It's like an anti-abuse role. Integrity is about sort of protecting people from using platforms to harm each other or society or democracy. And another way of putting it is like an integrity role is where you have a sort of systems eye view of how, you know, an information ecosystem is designed or being exploited. And your job is to sort of like think in a ecosystem level view as opposed to, you know, a narrowly caring about one feature. And the last way I might put it is, you know, an integrity role is one where you're not trying to drive up core company metrics that are, you know, growth, engagement, revenue. Instead, you're trying to increase quality or mitigate harms on the platform.
And is an integrity worker the same thing to you as somebody working in trust and safety, or do you see them as fundamentally different things?
Yeah, we talk about this like a fair amount. I think there's definitely overlap, and I think that some people are trying to make them interchangeable. I think that, you know, they just imply different things or have different like kinds of points of emphasis. Like for me, integrity work emphasizes product work, or what you might call responsible design. It emphasizes, again, sort of systems thinking and not just preventing harms, but also thinking about quality and sort of a holistic understanding. And trust and safety sort of brings the locus of its view to be policy, terms of service. It's much more about like policy, operations, content moderation. So, you know, it may well be that these the Venn diagram has the circles like mostly on top of each other, but the place that it sort of like implicitly emphasizes could be different. And I think that like the framing is different, right? Integrity is about structural integrity, understanding, you know, what's going on and preventing it from being overwhelmed and abused. Whereas trust and safety, I think, like says things like these platforms should be trusted. Should they? Or, you know, the highest value is safety. Is it? I don't know.
Those are really good questions. And that's part of what I like about the cheeky name of this podcast is trust in tech. Should you trust tech? Is there trust in tech? What does trust in tech mean? What are the people who work in trust at tech companies? I think it's still an open question, really, not just for this podcast, obviously, but in tech companies in general, is what does that trust mean? Who's responsible for creating it? Who's responsible for keeping it?
Yeah, and it's a weird field and a weird discipline, right? Because in some ways it's extremely old, and in some ways it's extremely young. Right? Like you can probably point back to work that people are doing in the 90s, right? Like in web 1.0 as like, oh yeah, like that is actually very clearly integrity work. Very clearly trust and safety work. It just wasn't called integrity work or trust and safety work, right? It was like the anti-spam team, you know, it was like the team trying to get rid of spam, and who knows what they called it, right? Or it was the search quality team at Google, that was worried about like high quality results versus low quality results. And so, you know, in some ways it's like over 20 years old, but it's just taken a while for tech as a whole to sort of respect it as, give it the respect it deserves, right? As like a proper discipline, as a proper field. So there's like so many things that are like in flux right now. And even though it's old, there's still a lot of things that still aren't super well-defined.
And that just reminds me, Jeff, like, I think a problem of like eBay ratings being gamed or Amazon products commingling, meaning that you can't, you know, like commingled inventory or third-party sellers, like, or even, I don't know, like fraudulent transactions on Stripe. Those are really clearly integrity problems to me. I'm not sure that you would call them trust and safety problems. And I think that that sort of like gets the sort of systemic part of it and the like ensuring quality being like a core part of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually, here's a fun little integrity problem for you, like for Amazon, right? Like Amazon has warehouses that are all over the place, right? Like has all sorts of like various shipping costs and shipping methods. And like, at what point does Amazon start recommending to you products that maybe are a little bit more expensive because the greenhouse, right? Like the environmental impact and climate change in terms of like shipping the products all around the world is better, right? And how do you rank products higher based on the smaller carbon footprint that they'll essentially take in order to get to the end users or the buyers, right? And like, not obviously a trust and safety issue, but like could very easily see like an integrity team, you know, thinking in terms of like, what is the overall impact that this platform is having on the world and how do we minimize the harm of it?
It's a really good example.
Now I want to go like find if anyone is thinking about that.
Me too. Next time I talk to somebody who works there, I will ask. So you've both been in this space for a while and seen things change over the years, as you were talking a little bit about, Jeff. What do you think the current state of integrity and platforms is right now? To somebody who isn't as involved in thinking deeply about these things as you are, how would you explain where we are today and the context of what's going on?
I think it really is a little bit of kind of, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I was lucky enough to get to go to TrustCon, which I forget exactly when it was, but it was, you know, a couple months ago. Managed to be able to attend that. Right after TrustCon was the Trust and Safety Research Conference. So these were conferences geared towards trust and safety professionals or academics that are sort of working in the trust and safety and integrity space. And it was amazing, right? Like it really felt like a moment for the field and the discipline of everyone who actually like cared about this space and wanted to make this space sort of much more prominent within tech, right? So, you know, you can think about, I'm gonna think about this from the engineering point of view, but there's a lot of different ways you can think about it. But, you know, on the engineering side, you can be a front-end dev, you can be a back-end dev, you can be an ML engineer. And we're sort of getting to this place where you can be a trust and safety engineer or an integrity engineer, right? It actually is sort of being fleshed out as a discipline and a genuine field within the tech space, which is really exciting, right? Like we're probably 15 years overdue for this kind of thing. And it's amazing to sort of be here, right? Like in the moment when it's happening. At the same time, right? It's like you fast forward a month and a half later and every single company is going through a round of layoffs. You know, integrity teams are being hit, right? Like, you know, people in the space trying to make the platform better are unfortunately having their jobs cut. And so obviously it's like, it's a really rough time for the industry and integrity and trust and safety work isn't being spared from that.
I have certainly seen a lot of reports of these teams getting laid off now. I have had some experiences myself of having to explain to CEOs why integrity work is critical and why it's not just a cost center and a line item where I'm spending tons of your money, that it actually is really critical to protecting the brand as a whole and the users as a whole. So I have my own ideas about how these teams are sometimes viewed, but I'd love from your perspective where you think that integrity teams fit into the greater tech ecosystem.
Yeah, this is such a good question. Throughout the journey of founding this organization and sort of talking about it and sort of coming up with our own theories of integrity, Jeff and I have been really leaning on the example and metaphor of cybersecurity. And I think that there's this thing that I think probably happens too often with security as well, where, you know, an executive says like, oh, we bought security. There's a department for it. Box checked, problem covered, cost center, contained, moving on with life. And of course, if you talk to a security person, you know, they'll say, you know, our job is about mitigating risk, not ending it. And we have this delicate dance of trying to get the rest of the company to do the right thing without freezing up product work so much that like nothing happens. And, you know, at the end of the day, the most secure company is one that doesn't exist. So, you know, we have to live in a world of trade-offs. That all applies here. And I think the cost center thing is really real and I think really unfortunate. And part of the reason that, again, I don't like the trust and safety framing, in part because it really encourages companies to, you know, put it in a box and call it a cost center and sort of try and squeeze the box over time. And you see sort of ways that people or firms have tried to get around this problem. So there's this term like responsible innovation or responsible design, which is sort of an attempt to place it in product. You know, there's different names for the same thing, like red teaming, like all these different ways to try and make it more the pulse of the organization and not just sort of an appendage to it. Kudos to Facebook. When I was talking to the security team at Facebook, a lot of them would say things like, you know, our job is to make the default ways of building things on the app secure. Our job isn't to like nag people to do a thing that is like annoying. Our job is to like work with the sort of defaults, you know, the default objects, the default libraries that developers use, so they don't have to worry about security because it has it. And my vision is something like that, but for design patterns for integrity. Maybe not libraries, but sort of like the design concepts that people have at hand are good by default. And integrity thinking sort of suffuses how people build products in the first place instead of being like brought in to sort of mitigate the harms once they're launched. But it's tough. That vision, I don't know if it exists anywhere yet. I'm sure there's little green shoots in different companies. You know, part of why we exist is to sort of champion that vision.
A little bit of a pithy way to say it, right? Is that like there's the smart way to respond and then the poorer, right? Like the stupid way to respond, right? And I think, you know, the less intelligent way to think about an integrity team is as this sort of like cost center that's like telling you what you can't do, right? But in reality, right, like integrity teams are kind of like the real growth teams, right? Like when it comes to growing a social media platform, you know, there's this tactics and strategies that you can use to sort of grow as fast as you can, you know, next week, right? And then there's the tactics and strategies that you can use to grow next year or the next 5 years or the next 10 years. And the longer term you think about your growth, the more and more you're going to need the sort of integrity mindset informing everything that you do. You know, because yes, like you can show people tons of misinformation and that is like super interesting and it will get people coming to the platform for a few days, but eventually people will get tired of it and a lot of users will be sick of seeing it and they will churn and stop using the app. And so, you know, the smart way to think about integrity teams is as your actual real long-term healthy growth teams.
We call it quality, right? Like what we care about is harms, but also quality. And like quality is part of building a good product that people want to come back to.
We can drill down, right? And actually like looking into a smaller system and optimizing a smaller system, right? So let's take, you know, feed ranking or Twitter, you know, timeline ranking or content recommendations, right? Generally, how all these systems work is they're trying to maximize the amount of engagement, right, that they get, right? So they have, you know, they're predicting for every piece of content that you might be able to see, they're predicting what are the odds that you will like it or retweet it or watch it. And, you know, the higher probabilities they're going to be showing it to you. Misinformation systematically scores higher on these things, actually. And all forms of harmful content systematically score higher on these things. And so obviously, like, you know, if you want to maximize engagement tomorrow, the system is going to skew towards, you know, showing people accounts that are posting misinformation or accounts that are posting hate speech, right? Because that's what's going to get the engagement. But actually, like a pretty clear way where this breaks down, right, is that if an account is repeatedly posting hate speech, for example, then there's a pretty good chance that eventually you're going to have to remove it from the platform for spreading so much hate speech, right? And so, you know, when an account is posting hate speech a ton, you kind of have to ask the question, well, what are the odds that this account will even be here 6 months from now or a year from now, given like how much hate speech it's posting? You know, one long-term way versus short-term way thinking about it, right? If you let the algorithms just focus only on the short-term, they actually might end up recommending a ton of content from spammy accounts and inauthentic accounts and accounts that are violating the terms of service, right? Like posting harmful content that aren't even going to be around in a year. Right. And so like if your recommendation engine is recommending content to people that is from from accounts that won't even be on the platform anymore in a year, then clearly this is short-term, you know, optimizing for the short-term and expense of the long-term, right? Like you could be recommending content from accounts that will be around for a year or 5 years or 10 years.
Not only that, but when you have accounts that are trying to silence other voices, being hateful, not behaving well, at its most extreme, it's hate speech, but there's more minor forms of that as well. That's going to drive people away. That's going to cut into your growth as a platform. People who don't feel welcome, don't feel comfortable, they're going to leave. And so allowing hate speech on a platform is actually reducing the freedom of speech for other people who no longer want to be around. And so that's something that I work with a lot, is really thinking about what are the values that a company says that they hold. Often diversity and inclusion is one of those. And then how do you actually act on that? How do you make sure that you have a diverse set of voices, that you're including everybody? And in order to include everybody, you actually can't include literally everybody, because if you include literally everybody, then you're including these really hateful, toxic accounts that are going to drive everybody else away. Those are your choices. So it's, I see, you know, integrity work and even content moderation work and trust and safety work as a way of sort of protecting brand values and not just the users or looking at individual pieces of content. It's much more strategic.
You can imagine a social network that like really wants people to form, I don't know, groups of people, you know, and those groups of people will just set up bad patterns, like bad default behavior. And if no one's minding the store after 5 years of that, all of your groups will be full of like really bad behavior. You know, whatever definition of bad you want, you know, borderline harassing, like low quality, plagiarism, whatever you want. At this point, if you as a platform want to crack down on it, you can't. That's like the you know, a huge fraction of your total engagement. You'd be tanking the site if you took it all off. But because it's so entrenched, there's no you're sort of stuck with it, right? You can't just create a new rule that says, oops, actually you can't harass anymore because it's so normalized. Where would you start? People would say, this was fine yesterday, or my friend did it. Why am I being singled out? No amount of sort of nudges are going to get you back on the good path. And all your users that like would respond to your incentives for good behavior have already left. I really see it as like a long-term quality thing. And the other thing, you know, you brought up freedom of speech, which is sort of like a conversation that stalks conversations like this and that I find really frustrating. And my pithy sort of pin on that is you can't spam fake Ray-Bans on Facebook, let's say. And also Twitter is going to reorder what posts you see to increase the expected value of something. And if you live in a world of reordering or you can't spam fake Ray-Bans, then at that point, you're just quibbling over where the line is because the line's been drawn somewhere. Something is being optimized and the question is only like, what are you optimizing for? And that's the world we live in.
It's a really good point that actually when all of this fails, right? Like this actually is how a platform can almost enter a death spiral, right? You let hate speech run rampant. You drive away anyone that isn't interested in hate speech. They're off your platform and now you're just sort of stuck. So it's like, what do? Do you kill hate speech and then everyone who stayed like no longer has a use case for your platform? Or do you get, you know, do you try to like rebrand yourself and you have to like almost like try to convince your users to come back? It absolutely can be sort of like a death spiral mode.
What do you think the future of integrity work is? If a company is adamant about not going on that death spiral, they're going to do it correctly from the beginning, they're going to use all the cutting edge technology and systems of thinking through these things, what do you think is coming next?
If only there was some kind of like, you know, briefing or document that laid out best practices for new startups and integrity, some sort of like polished, beautiful, piece of wisdom and advice and technical, but also sort of office politics best practices, man, that would be something, wouldn't it?
And if, you know, a group of people from different places in the industry with different roles and different experiences at different companies contributed to it, that would really give it a breadth of knowledge that everyone could learn from.
We haven't officially launched it. So if you're an enterprising journalist and want to break the story, email us at hello@integrityinstitute.org and we'll give you the scoop.
Yeah, I mean, like, and like sort of on that point, right? Like I think the future of integrity work isn't necessarily about the companies. I think it's more about the people doing the work. And I think one thing that we're all very, like, everyone in the integrity space is very much like woken up to this sort of fact, right? That building social media platforms is an ethical endeavor, right? Like there's a lot of ethical considerations that you have to keep in mind as you go about building social media platforms, which means that we need sort of codes of ethics, codes of conduct for the people that are gonna be going about doing that, right? And I think hopefully these codes of conduct and this respect of the ethics of what we are doing is gonna be coming from the people doing the work, right? Like hopefully we will have a pretty large voice in saying what that is. You know, one analogy that I personally like to point to a lot, you know, just in the spirit of sort of, you know, humanity has sort of been in these kind of situations where there's a new form of media that's causing a lot of, you know, externalities, right, like on society, is actually the formation of the Associated Press, right? So in, you know, the 1910s, right, journalists got together and they said, you know what, journalism is an ethical profession. There's ethical considerations, you know, when you are a journalist and how you do your job. And let's all come together and say, this is what it means to be a journalist. And these are the things that we care about. And these are, you know, sort of the rules of the road and the guardrails that we will put on ourselves as we go about doing our work. And, you know, hopefully, we are kind of seeing that now, right, with the integrity and trust and safety fields and disciplines forming.
And to your point, Jeff, I just say, like, again, to be clear, we have an integrity Hippocratic oath. It's on our website, and you have to swear this oath in order to be a member, but you don't have to be a member to swear the oath. And part of what we hope to see is, like, you know, my metaphor of this is like in integrity work, it's kind of like being a lawyer or a doctor. You know, if you're a doctor, you know how to kill someone. You probably know how to kill someone in a way that is like undetectable even. And yet you don't, because you have you're not going to see doctors for hire being assassins because they have a system of ethics and values in their profession. Like lawyers too, you know, like a lawyer could kill someone with paperwork, but well, maybe that's a bad example. But like this has to be the kind of profession where you have a loyalty to sort of the public and a system of ethics, as opposed to only a loyalty to your employer. And the reason for this is that the tools that we use are powerful and could be used for evil. And we're actually really lucky that integrity workers right now, by and large, are amazing, ethical people who care. And that's in part from the economic structure of the situation, where if you're an integrity worker, often it's not amazing for your career and for a cost center when you're used to being a, you know, honored member of the firm in like the heart of product. So while we have this window, we really want to like cement this as sort of the ethical norm, so that if your boss asks you to do a thing that is unethical, you know that you can have, you know, thousands of fellow integrity workers raising a stink, backing you up, going to the people in power. And it's not just you saying like, oh, by the way, I'm just a rando who has an opinion about this is unethical. But, you know, there's like a well understood guiding document that everyone knows exists ahead of time. Maybe we don't talk about it too much. So you gave me the opportunity. I just really want to harp on that.
In a lot of ways, this is friendly towards the company and friendly towards the industry too, right? It's like, we are workers in this industry. We want to see this industry succeed, right? Like we do want to see a social media that actually helps, you know, people thrive, helps societies thrive, is good for democracy. And hopefully, you know, we develop a set of ethics, right? And norms that are sort of like, employer, you want me to do this, but you know, that is in our short-term interest. It's not in our long-term interest. The guardrails tell me to act in this way. And ultimately that is what is in the company's best interest, right? Like it's not in the industry's interest for social media to continue to be, you know, this sort of pariah that's causing all these externalities that everyone's terrified about. And eventually, you know, if you keep on doing that, right, like there's going to be tons of regulation that end up, you know, shackling the industry and not actually letting it live up to its actual real potential. And so just hopefully we get to a place, right, where it's like ethics are good for everyone, right? Like if you have the right sort of vision of what you're doing.
And to the point of like, we work here and we want it to be good. Some of what we do is, you know, journalists, policymakers will sometimes ask us for our honest broker opinion on like things they're working on or ideas they have. And, you know, we're happy to be asked and happy to help from the perspective of, you know, scientists who are sort of helping people understand how to best meet their goals. And sometimes I just feel bubbling up is a sort of like, oh, let's like regulate them so that they like we do with privacy. Let's like add all these hoops they have to jump through. We can't trust them. And, you know, often Jeff and I will push back and say, we represent our members. And what you're proposing is making our members' lives hell. And like so much paperwork and so much bureaucracy. And the end of the day, our members are fighting the good fight and they're trapped in systems, or they work in systems that, you know, often value engagement and growth over quality. And like, that's the problem to work on, not, you know, burdening our members. And so, you know, sometimes we talk more about how we're holding platforms accountable, but I just want to be very clear that like, we're here to champion platforms when they do the right thing and like look out for, you know, what's true and right in our members' interests as well. And like, we've done a lot of, you know, if like a journalist writes a hit piece against a company that is just simply unfair, we will contact the journalist behind the scenes and say like, hey, you got this wrong. And that's important to do too.
One of the things as a member of the Integrity Institute that I was really impressed by is I actually think that the operations of the Integrity Institute is in itself a model for how social media companies and tech companies could work, because you're obviously optimizing for quality of membership, for really strong onboarding processes. Like, Sahar, you got on a Zoom call and talked to me for an hour about everything to make sure that I seemed like a decent person before you let me in. And, you know, that kind of really intentional, ethical growth, I think, is a model that can be used for any kind of community, including social media communities. Is that something that you thought about when you're creating this onboarding process of like, we're the people who are saying you have to do it differently and do it better, so let's use our own community as a model for that?
Mm-hmm. Alice, what a wonderful softball question. Wow, thank you.
You're so welcome. But it's true.
Yeah. We explicitly thought about it. And I just want to give a lot of credit to Cassandra Marquetos, our senior advisor on how to run a community, who's also a member and also on staff, who helped us think through this, like how to operationalize it. But even from the very beginning, before we had any staff, we said things like, you know, our target membership by the end of the year was 100 people. And we've hit that 100, I think, without any sort of recruiting or advertising or sort of really outreach. We've sort of relied on people to come to us because they think that what we're doing is important, rather than really sort of like begging them to join. One thing that we've sort of talked earlier is about like think about dating apps. The difference between JSwipe and Tinder is not really much in terms of code. The difference between JSwipe and Tinder is like, who are the first users and what are the norms on the app? A lot of what makes a product is actually the first users and the norms they set and what kind of, you know, intangible things crystallize around those people. And so we were really intentional around who our first 12 members would be, who our first 15 members would be after we went public. We put more of a process around the first batch of 15 and then the batch of 20. members that we added, like we added them in batches. We had a lot of conversations. We like had more care into that onboarding experience. Whereas now we add people, you know, one by one, not in batches, because we can trust the community to sort of acculturate them over time. And that was all very intentional.
I'll just say, like, the jokey answer is, you know, as someone who worked as an integrity on an integrity team at Facebook, I've seen what happens to groups that grow, you know, 10,000 members a day or 10,000 members a week, and they're absolute chaos factories. And so I'm very glad we went with the slow and steady rather than adding 10,000 people into one online space overnight.
Thank you so much for speaking with me about integrity and the Integrity Institute. Is there anything that you want to say in closing thoughts about any of these topics?
Now you're really putting us on the spot.
Oh man, I mean, I'll go. Alice, integrity workers are heroes. They deserve to be honored. They deserve to be applauded. They should be stopped by, you know, sweet old ladies on the street and have them say, thank you for your service. On top of that, just like, thank you for making this podcast. Dear listeners, Jeff and I did not make this podcast. This was an organic bubbling up from members. Like, isn't that so cool? Isn't it just amazing that Alice, you and the team decided to make it happen and now you're doing it. And I just like really appreciate you having us on, but I also appreciate, you know, just highlighting other members and other people doing the work because they deserve to be heard and not just have people speak about them or for them. You know, we talked a little bit about like the good culture inside of the Institute and how members are so wonderful. And I think that you, plural, are some of the people who help make that happen and model that good behavior every day.
Yeah, and just really highlights how, you know, integrity workers are the coolest kind of tech workers and actually really care about getting the stuff right for society and doing the work wherever it can be done.
Yeah, we've had so many interesting conversations privately within the group that I thought highlighting some of our amazing people was the least that we could do and the mission of the whole Institute, which I really believe in. So thank you very much for coming to explain some of this. And thank you so much for all the hard work that you've been doing and for creating a really cool community that I can be part of.
And thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Trust in Tech is hosted by Alice Hunsberger and produced by Tal Habib. Edited by Alice Hunsberger. Music by Zhao Shen. Special thanks to Sahar Masachi and Cassandra Markatos for their continued support, and to all the members of the Integrity Institute.